Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, filling in today for Lori Walsh. So what are macroeconomists thinking and dreaming about these days? Well, I'm glad you asked. Earlier this month, the American Economic Association held its annual meeting and a three-day conference in San Diego, California, and our own Joe Santos was there. He's a professor in the Department of Economics at South Dakota State University, and every week he brings us the morning macro, both here on In the Moment and online at schooled.blog.com. Joe joins us now from the Janine Basinger Studio on the SDSU campus. Joe, welcome back to In the Moment.
Thank you, Jackie. It's good to be back.
All right. So let's start with a little bit of context about American Economic Association, if you would. Tell us a little bit about this organization and this annual meeting you went to.
Sure. So this organization has been in place since the late 19th century, 1885, believe it or not. This is an organization that economists, but many social sciences, scientists more generally, are a member of. We meet every year at various locations in the United States, and there's really sort of two parts to the meeting, what we refer to affectionately as the meetings, but it's really just a conference. It's a three-day conference and filled with various sessions throughout every day on issues of all manner of economics. It's also an enormous job fair, which is something a lot of folks probably don't know about. Anyone who's completing a PhD, for example, and looking to obtain a job in academia or in the policy space in government and so forth will also attend, and their potential employers will attend. And so there's this enormous matching process that's going on. So there are a whole bunch of people who look really anxious, and then there are a bunch of people who are just there to enjoy the ride. And so it's quite interesting to see the contrast. I attended this year in San Diego, and I try to get to as many sessions as I can. And in doing so, because my interests are so deeply aligned with macroeconomics, tried to attend as many sessions on macro as I could. And so while I was there, I thought, you know, there seemed to be a few prevailing themes coming across to me at these various sessions, and perhaps it might be interesting to share these themes with our audience.
Absolutely. And this is a very big conference, thousands and thousands of people attending with an interest in economics. And so you get kind of a cross-section of what's top of mind for these scholars in this area. So you outlined in your blog this week three key takeaways that you got from this year's conference. Let's start with the first topic. Tell us what you can about secular stagnation.
Yeah, so this was talked about an awful lot. And secular stagnation is, I don't want to say it's a loaded term, but it's one that macroeconomists will often think about in the context of the Great Depression. Mm. Alvin Hansen was the president of the American Economics Association in 1938, and he gave his presidential address, as all presidents do at this conference. And in that address, he, I think, coined the phrase secular stagnation, which he just described as sick recoveries which die in their infancy and depressions which feed on themselves. That's a wonderful message. But he was, of course, talking about an economy in 1938 that had been expanding for all of 6 months after a recession, which rather quickly followed came after the Great Depression. So he was talking about a period of very low economic growth and a period of very low inflation. And he was arguing that essentially the solution to this, what was not forthcoming, was a sufficient amount of what he referred to as invention, sort of development through capital formation. So investing in plant and equipment and infrastructure and various innovations. And he argued that that's what was missing. And absent that so-called capital formation, the United States economy was doomed to this thing he called secular stagnation. Well, that term is being used quite a bit these days, appropriately or otherwise, to describe the current U.S. economy. Now, that sounds a bit odd at first, I admit. We are in the longest expansion since the Second World War. We don't have the kinds of unemployment rates that Alvin Hansen observed when he was talking about secular stagnation. But nevertheless, as we've discussed on this program before, economic growth has been shall we say, underwhelming. And inflation has been uncharacteristically low. And so this has led some economists to sort of borrow this term in describing the current economy. And so some of the sessions I attended were all about this sort of conundrum of whether or not what we are observing is some version, albeit not Hansen's version, but some version of secular stagnation. And those who are arguing this, you could imagine, have a policy prescription in mind. and that is that essentially there is a role for government to play at this time to increase what we would call public investment. There's private investment. That's your firm down the street deciding to increase plant size or invest in equipment. But the government can do this too. And so a lot of the folks who are arguing that they see something akin to secular stagnation are also arguing that there could be a role here for government to play in beefing up infrastructure, in fueling research and development, investments in human capital, funding education, what have you. But it certainly comes with, that is the accusation, if you will, that we're stuck in this mud, often comes with this policy prescription, which is to say there's a role here for government that we may have overlooked. So that seemed to take up a lot of the oxygen in San Diego in various sessions I attended.
Interesting. And to that end, when we're talking about potential government intervention in these scenarios, your second key takeaway is this counter-cyclical fiscal policy, which you're telling me isn't necessarily the most broadly popular approach to economic policy, but it has that government intervention piece. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this was something else that came up a bit, and it was the idea that we should bring back, if you will, fiscal policy as one of the tools in the policy toolbox in order to stabilize the economy if and when we find ourselves in an economic contraction. We're not there now, but these folks were arguing if we find ourselves there again, monetary policy, which is sort of the favorite kid of the family, the policy family, may not be what we need because it may not be very effective. And your listeners will probably recognize why if you look around and look at interest rates and you see what the Federal Reserve has done with interest rates. They've taken them about as low as they could. And so the thinking is you may need the other policy, and that is fiscal. And this is government spending, government taxing, and doing so in what we call a counter-cyclical fashion. In other words, working against the cycle. So if the economy is contracting, you would be using taxing and spending in order to limit the contraction. So very concretely, you would be lowering taxes or you would be increasing spending. And the interesting issue in this session and others like it was an argument not just to sort of bring back this policy, which has really fallen out of favor. You know, monetary policy is sort of the cool kid, and to bring it back and to reconsider it. And incidentally, not just in terms of practice, but also in the academe, it's not something a lot of folks are working on, certainly not the way they're working on issues of monetary policy, and bring it back in what's called a rules-based approach. And I found this very interesting, arguing essentially it won't be enough to rely on policymakers to use taxing or spending if a crisis presents itself because of this resistance to that sort of policy. Mm. And so what these folks were arguing, I thought was pretty provocative, saying, why don't we write down those laws now, tying the hands, if you will, of the policymaker to implement fiscal policies in circumstances where that would be necessary. So, for example, state ahead of time that if the economy contracts by such and such, we will lower payroll taxes by such and such. Again, just an example, one that they were raising at this session. But the interesting point again here is that they're arguing to stipulate a rule ahead of time. Now, for the real macro policy wonks in the audience, they may recognize that typically when you're trying to tie the hands of a policymaker, you're trying to get them to not do policy. Mm-hmm. In this case, you're trying to tie their hands in a way that actually forces them to respond because there's such a resistance to using this sort of policy. So in some sense, it's gotten that bad. We so rarely turn to fiscal policy anymore that some of these folks are arguing maybe we have to set up rules that essentially implement the policy, whether or not at that moment the policymaker has, let's say, the stomach to do it.
Right. How likely do you suppose that is? Do we have much of a historical context for how often policymakers are kind of willing to bend their ear towards the economists with a long-ranging vision of what might be helpful in the future?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I sat there thoroughly entertained by the discussion and thinking this doesn't have a chance. With monetary policy, you have this sort of quasi-independent agency. What they do in terms of implementing monetary policy does not require appropriations from the legislature. It's in some ways simpler, in some ways, again, in that they don't have to use taxpayer dollars. They are literally creating bank reserves and so on and so forth. The idea of a rule, I think, has more practical application. But in the case of a fiscal rule, your question is getting right to the heart of the problem. This means essentially not tying the hands of the policymaker at the end of the day. You're tying the hands of the legislator, and it may be a legislator who isn't even there yet, right? So it's she hasn't taken her position yet, but you're binding that individual to a taxing or spending commitment in the rule. And so the notion that any legislative body would approve such a thing seems to me to be rather far-fetched. And to be fair, they may resist it on the grounds of sort of democratic small d, democratic principles, that this is not the way we appropriate taxpayer dollars. We don't sort of commit them in advance according to some macroeconomic algorithm.
Sure.
And so I think it's a bit far-fetched, but I thought it was very provocative, a very interesting approach. And if nothing else, reflects just how, if you will, out of favor fiscal policy has become.
Interesting. I imagine it runs quite a bit afoul of what at least many people would recognize as a free market sort of approach. It gets a little too government, perhaps a little too involved in that process, and can make a few people sweat a little more than they would normally.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's sort of ironic, right? You're trying to get folks to overcome their inhibition to fiscal policy. And to your point, exactly what you end up doing is asking them to commit in a way that seems very sort of Orwellian and, you know, just very uncomfortable to them, that we're going to write these equations down and that's going to specify how we behave going forward. It's sort of, fiscal policy and AI or something.
Oh, that sounds like a whole other conversation we could have. Oh, dear. But I want to make sure we get time to your third takeaway from this year's meeting, and that is, debt. Just about all of us can talk about debt, but what sorts of worries are at top of mind for folks looking at a macroeconomy perspective?
Sure. So this was what was so interesting about these sessions is that, as you say, they were all about debt and the sustainability of debt. But here's the difference. It wasn't, oh, my gosh, how much higher is this debt going to go, and is it going to explode, and are we going to be, you know, name your country that had some sort of cataclysmic debt crisis. On the contrary, it was recognizing that these interest rates that we now observe, at least the rates that government pays on its debt. That's an important point. But if we're worried about government debt, the argument went something like this. We have to realize that the interest rate that the government is paying on its debt is very low right now. So very concretely, a 10-year treasury bond is paying a rate that's relatively low relative to, not just historically speaking, but relative to the growth in the economy. So there's this funny little algebra that plays out that says, if you're paying less to service your debt, then your economy is growing, then in some ways your income is winning the race. It's this race between the growth in your income and the growth in your debt servicing costs. If your income is going faster, then actually debt sort of ceases to be a problem, right? So this was recognizing this relationship, as I say in the blog, which economists refer to affectionately, only economists could do this, as R less than G. R, the interest rate you're paying on the debt, and G, the growth in the economy. And they're saying, hey, R is less than G. It's almost never less than G. But if it is less than G, then that means maybe we could outpace our debt servicing burden simply by growing the economy, which leads to the next very provocative suggestion, and that is, why don't we take on more debt? So the session was all about debt and debt sustainability, but not in the way a lot of folks might at first think. It wasn't, oh my gosh, this is going to explode. What are we going to do? It was, oh my gosh, the debt servicing costs are so low for the federal government. Why doesn't the federal government go deeper into debt, essentially passing this burden on to the next generation, but a next generation who's living in an economy that's growing even faster than the one we're growing in, right? So this was the idea that maybe there's a kind of a Ponzi scheme. They actually called it out, a Ponzi scheme that one could exploit, going deeper into debt because of this interesting relationship right now that is completely a result of these historically low interest rates. I should say the conjecture, it's referred to as the Blanchard conjecture. Olivia Blanchard, once a president of the AEA himself, proposed this about a year ago. And so the sessions were about the so-called Blanchard conjecture. And I should say the session I attended was all about why this is nuts. But in fairness, the AEA is an equal opportunity club. But nevertheless, it was a very interesting discussion and one that I thought maybe Morning Macro listeners would really not expect. It was quite the opposite when you hear debt.
Yeah, you don't hear the idea of, hey, now is the time to accrue more debt, actually. That's rarely
that's right.
top of mind.
And I should say there is a don't try this at home part feature of this. The government is borrowing at very low rates. So even let's say you're sort of convinced by this argument, it works mathematically because the government has very low costs of borrowing. The rest of us don't. So for most of us in our households, R is greater than G.
Yes.
Our income is not winning the race against our debt servicing costs. So this is not something anyone should try at home. But the argument is that maybe the federal government could exploit this interesting relationship.
So, Joe, you're a professor at SDSU. You get a chance to go to a big conference like this, and I can imagine it's very exciting just for your own professional benefit. But I'm curious how, as you enter into a new semester, getting a chance to experience something like this and talk with economists from all over the country, how does this influence how you enter a new semester and work with your students?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. It's sort of top of mind for me because I'm still noticing the sort of the burning the fumes of the conference. it has a way of really rejuvenating someone intellectually, and it certainly had that effect on me. Of course, it was sunny and 70 degrees. That may have had something to do with it as well. But funny you should ask. So this semester, we have a graduate program here at the Ness School, and it's in economics proper, and so I teach advanced macroeconomic theory. So tomorrow, there are a bunch of poor souls who are going to have to tolerate my enthusiasm. as a result of this conference. But it's a good question. It really does sort of, if you will, recharge the batteries. There are things that I bring into the classroom in very concrete ways, charts I saw, figures, ways of thinking about things that will definitely form the way I teach the advanced degree course. There is a very close connection between sort of what I take away from these experiences and how I bring those experiences back to the classroom. And I think I speak for my colleagues when I say this as well. Throughout the university, I suspect this is a very common phenomenon.
Well, your enthusiasm is contagious to me, so I can only imagine how it transfers to students majoring in this. So, Joe, I want to thank you for taking the time. My guest has been Joe Santos. He's a professor at SDSU in economics, talking about this week's blog, The Morning Macro. You can read this and many past installments at schooled.blog.com. That's schooled, D-O-T, blog.com. Joe, thanks so much for joining us today. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you, Jackie.